The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
What does spies have to do with your eyes?
What's the difference between an agent and an operative?
And is it pronounced covert or covert?
Join us as we go undercover to declassify etymological intelligence, decrypt historical ciphers, and conduct surveillance on famous spies in this espionage-themed episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jessa Ferris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are doing espionage etymology, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're talking about the covert, or should that be covert? I think we'll probably get into that at some point during this. Yeah, the words related to what those in the game call tradecraft, espionage, sneaking around and spying on people.
Sharing a little bit of intelligence on this etymology.
Indeed, true intelligence as well. Where should we start? Should we start with that word spy, Jess?
Oh, absolutely we should.
Does it relate to just, you know, espying someone? I guess it does, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The word spy is older in English. Like, we're talking about espionage here. The word spy is older in English than espionage, as you might guess, by about 400 years. But we had a lot of words like that for a long time before, and they're all from the same Germanic source, espying and things. It's also related to words like inspect and suspect and spectacle. So it's all about looking.
Espionage, which we will get into, you know, it comes from exactly the same place as the word spy. These words are related for sure. I was looking at when the word spy was first used in English. I think it will surprise people, particularly if your image of a spy is James Bond, for example, although I think maybe he's a secret agent rather than a spy. But the first citation is in a 14th century translation of the Bible, which I thought was kind of interesting, in Genesis and Exodus. Okay, this is
Old Testament.
yes, indeed. Right up top of the Bible. It's written in Middle English. I'll read it in the Middle English and then I'll sort of translate it. But it's basically, it seems well that ye spies been and into this land come to see and for to spy your lord the king. So it seems well that you are spies and you've come into this country to see the lord your king.
So it's more just like looking at, you are the people who have come to look at things, spectators, you might say.
Spectators, exactly. A word related to that Germanic word that you mentioned earlier. And yeah, to espy, we don't use the word espy very often, but it's very much linked to the idea of being a spy. A spy is one who espies things. But you mentioned about espionage. So espionage enters English quite a lot later, doesn't it?
400 years later.
It becomes the word for the overall craft of spying, organized spying. And it's borrowed from French in the 18th century. There's some really interesting spy stuff going on in France in the 18th century. I don't know if you looked into this. Jess.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. And we get some words that we use today sound a little more French around spying than you would expect because of the Napoleonic Wars and things like that.
There was also something that was set up by the French king at the time who really sort of pushed, who's responsible for a whole network of espionage across Europe. He was Louis the 15th, so not Louis the 14th, Sun King, but the one after that. And he had an organization known as the Secret du Roi, which means the king's secret. And this organization dispatched French spies all over Europe. A lot of them were in Russia, for example. But I was looking this up and who these spies were, because they were famous, you know, in their day, some of these spies. And one of them, absolutely fascinating character, called the Chevalier d'Eon. They go by two names, Chevalier d'Eon and Chevalière d'Eon, the masculine and feminine versions.
It is interesting, too, that you're using they as a pronoun for this person, and I think I know why.
Yeah, indeed. It's an anachronism, obviously, to think of people from that period as non-binary. However, if anyone was, it was the Chevalier d'Eon, known as both Charlotte and Charles in their time. They were a spy who managed to sneak into various places by pretending to be both a man and pretending to be a woman. They presented in their daily life as a fella, and they had manly jobs throughout their life, but they did, for example, manage to con their way into the court in Russia, the court of the Empress, by pretending to be a woman. And you look at drawings of the Chevalier, the Chevalier, and they are, you know, noticeably androgynous. You can see how they did manage to present as both male and female. What a fascinating character, and a character who lived in London and was, you know, subject of much rumor while they were there and much fascination.
Ultimately, I think the pronoun would make the most sense as she, because in 1777, she started living fully as a woman and was recognized by Louis the 16th as a woman.
I didn't know that. I know they spent most of their life presenting as a man, but if they ended it as a woman, let's go with that.
All of the illustrations and art of them has them androgynous, or in one particular one, half in a dress and half in menswear.
Yeah, it was an aspect of the curiosity around the Chevalier / Chevalier, around Charles / Charlotte, that they were this androgyne, I suppose.
One of the other French terms that I think is worth bringing up here and was introduced due to the Napoleonic Wars is the term reconnaissance. It is basically an etymological doublet of recognizance in English, because it literally means recognition, and it's from the same Latin words and elements. But recognizance now means something else and always meant something else. And reconnaissance was used mostly during the Napoleonic Wars in French in relation to spies.
Right. So if you go on a recce, you're basically checking out an area before you attempt to go there, aren't you?
Right. Meanwhile, recognizance is older, but originally referred to an obligation to which you are legally or formally bound, a formal bond or recognition that you're going to do something as part of an agreement or acknowledge the allegiance of someone else. And then today we have it in the phrase discharged upon one's own recognizance, which means you're being released without bail due to good behavior, and your signature is the recognition of that and your promise to come back. The variation of this word that I hate, due to the pronunciation, is reconnoiter. I don't like how that rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, I really don't like it. I would never attempt to say it. In fact, one of the reasons I think people say recce is to avoid having to say reconnoiter, because it's horrible.
No one here that I have ever heard, maybe I travel in non-espionage-related circles, but no one says recce here.
Well, you know, it's used a lot in broadcasting.
That's
one of the things. And they probably, I expect they use it at television stations in America as well. Basically, if you want to go and check whether a place is a suitable place to film, you do a recce there. I, Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I expect it gets used over there too.
I haven't heard it in TV stations that I've been in, but I don't know that it isn't in use. And I would love for someone to tell us too.
Please be do.
But I reckon that the pronunciation of it is influenced by reckon, which is not related to any of these words. As we've discussed before, it's a Germanic word meaning to count or recount or consider.
After the feast, the reckoning, the calculation of the bill.
We're jumping all over the map time-wise, but I do have some of the first famous spies that were called spies as we know them today in English. And this is from the 13th to the 15th centuries during the Anglo-French Wars. Edward III of England and Philip VI and Charles VI of France notably ran wartime intelligence through multilingual courtiers and merchants and soldiers and household servants who gathered military information by listening inside courts and camps. And some of the bigger medieval spy scandals were really fun. The first Englishman to be executed for espionage as a crime was Sir Thomas Turberville, who was a knight captured in 1295, who spied for France and sent intelligence on English defenses. And he was horribly and publicly executed after royals found incriminating letters that he had written about his spying.
Surely the first rule of spying is don't write down that you're doing the spying.
Well, we can talk about lots of different ways to write down spy information in a few minutes. But fun one was in 1386, the English sent a soldier named Hennequin du Bos to infiltrate French noble households connected to invasion planning in Flanders. And he was also captured and tortured and executed in Paris. And his interrogation exposed a huge English spy network operating across northern and western France.
Yeah, you've got to be brave to be a spy in those days, haven't you? Well, you've got to be brave to be a spy, full stop.
In general, but it was socially acceptable to draw and quarter people. So
you say socially acceptable, like people were doing it on a Friday evening. I don't think it happened that often.
I mean, we read about it because it was horrible, I'm sure.
I don't fancy it at all. No, thank you.
What do we call the information that these spies gather?
So you mentioned it just then in your description, and I guess it's sort of anachronistic to call it intelligence. I guess they wouldn't have called it intelligence in those days, but is intelligence the word you're looking for?
Yes, but the notion of undercover spy intelligence actually dates back to the 16th century.
Intelligence, that does mean knowledge, doesn't it? As we otherwise know it to. And in this sense, that is like a transferred, the way we talk about it is in like military intelligence or secret intelligence and stuff. Is that basically, you know, gaining knowledge about something?
Oh, basically, yeah. And this is just a jargony use of the term intelligence, right?
Right, okay.
Though I will note that counterintelligence, the act of preventing enemies from obtaining secret information, is from the 1940s. So that one is more recent.
Oh, there we go.
I guess this is more of a detective term, but I feel like these are pretty tied up together. We talk about the word investigate. I am sure this is easily observable, but I hadn't thought through the notion that the word investigate includes the word vestige.
Oh, okay. Now you mention it. So I suppose I'd always thought that it was, and maybe this is related to it. So to investment, right, is basically to put clothes on, isn't it? Like to put a vest.
But investigate is from a different root entirely.
Yeah. And now you've said that. That's a revelation to me. I assumed, never bothering to actually look it up, that it must have something to do with
like you're
clothing,
invested in the case or something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You're getting stuck right in there. Like you're almost so into it, you're wearing it. So tell us about how vestige fits in.
Vestige is ultimately from the Latin vestigium, which meant in Latin footprint or trace. So the first use in English of the word vestige was describing the visible place where a building existed once but doesn't anymore. And that's how we got the sense of something that is no longer present or active, like vestigial organs and things. But to investigate is literally to follow somebody's footprints.
Oh, I like that. Isn't that nice?
Isn't it?
Isn't that satisfying? Because that's exactly what you've got in your head when you think of an investigation.
Right? Little footprints.
Oh, that's adorable. I like that.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. There are a few other sort of basic terms associated with spycraft that we should mention. Things like the difference between an agent and an asset, for example.
Ooh,
these are mildly different things.
The word agent is pretty versatile, right? Like, it's generally speaking, it is someone who acts or performs an action, and it's related to the word act. And it's a really old word in English, and it's not necessarily affiliated with what we would call secret agents until the early 1800s, apparently during the Aaron Burr conspiracy in the United States, which was a vast plot led by former US President Aaron Burr, who planned to work with a number of powerful American figures to create their own empire in the American West. And that's when we got agent as like a secret agent.
You know, an agent is someone who's like, is working on behalf of a secret agency, but is not like an official employee, right? This is quite a key distinction. They're not like, they're not a pen pusher. And then you've got assets, right? Which is anyone or thing that provides information to a secret service.
Yeah, and I think all of these are supposed to be originally neutral terms that you wouldn't recognize as being elements of like criminal activity or secret stuff. And now they've just become, through spy fiction and through popular use and the popular imagination, words that we affiliate with spycraft entirely.
Yeah, the definitions are deliberately mundane for these words, you know. And for example, spies, referring to what they do as trade craft, is a really good example of choosing the sort of most dull, non-specific terms they can come up with, so that, you know, if they get overheard, no one knows really what they're talking about.
And it's like, because we read novels about spies, we start to affiliate those words ourselves with that. Actually, I had one fact here that I thought was really interesting. The notion of a mole as a sleeper agent is first found in the 1920s, with most sources like the Morning Post writing about the underground burrowings of the Bolshevist moles, but it wasn't fully popularized until the Cold War. And the thing that got me, though, is that the OED says that it's likely that the world of espionage took the word mole from spy novels and not the other way around.
Yeah.
John le Carré's novels in particular, like Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, appear to have played the biggest role in popularizing mole as a word for a deep cover agent.
You know, there's a lot of terms that I think people only know from John le Carré's works. I, for example, only know what a dead drop is from John le Carré's books, right? Although I was having a look through, if you'll indulge me on this, the CIA actually publishes a glossary of their terms, presumably not their most secret terms. But among them are terms like dead drop, for example, which the CIA describes as a secret location where material can be left, sometimes in a concealment device, for someone else to then retrieve, often used between an intelligence officer and their asset or agent. Those terms we've already mentioned. So it's like you leave a message behind a bush or underneath a lamp post. You can't put something underneath a lamp post. These are terrible dead drop examples for someone else to then come along and pick up later. They're usually public places. But I didn't know a dead drop was until I can't remember which of le Carré's novels it was. All right, because you read one of le Carré's novels, you end up reading all of them. So that was one of the terms in there. But another term I hadn't come across from the CIA glossary was flaps and seals, which is what they call the trade craft of clandestinely, however you like to pronounce it, opening, reading, and resealing envelopes or packages without the recipient's knowledge, which does make sense, flaps and seals. But and it does sound funny, doesn't it?
Speaking of which, the word clandestine, it's been around since the 1560s, and of course it means secret or private or furtive. The word it's based on is an adverbial version of the Latin calare, meaning to hide. That word is clam.
Like, yeah, I love this. The Latin for secretly is clam.
Clam, which is also amazing because, like, that's not where we get the notion of to clam up, because that's just being like a clam. And it's not related to the word clam, as in the clam, but it is neat that it does both. It's serendipitous.
Yeah, I think I remember you telling me this actually in another episode where we were talking about
clams.
We were, yeah, and the idea of clamming up and this coincidence of Latin's word for doing something secretly being the same as a clam.
Yeah, the clam organism, animal, mollusk, is named after, it's an Old English word that means grip or grasp.
Can we talk about other words for doing things clandestinely? And in fact, we should talk about the word secret as well, because it's kind of an interesting word in itself. You know, it's very obvious, it seems, what it means, but when you look into the etymology, it takes you to a place you might not quite expect, because the root of the word secret, it doesn't mean secret, it means set apart, like something that has been set apart. So something that is secrete or secret, as you know, was an adjective at one time, is something that is set apart. And so I had a revelation while I was looking this up. We've talked about contronyms before, words that are their own opposites. And I think the word secrete might be one. Hear me out on this. Okay. So to secrete something can mean to hide it, right? To secrete something away. But secrete can also mean to emit something, to put something out there.
Yes, okay.
So that makes it a contronym.
Yeah, no, I agree that. I agree with that. I accept this proposal.
I'm glad you do. So how can it be a contronym is what I was looking up. And the reason is that we get the idea of, you know, a plant secretion or an animal secretion from the fact that these goos, it's usually a goo that's being secreted,
get separated.
It's not that they're separated on the outside. It's that they usually come from some sort of organ inside the body that has secreted them, that has separated them apart from all of the other goos inside of that particular animal. So a bladder, for example, separates, you know, your urine away from other stuff. And then it is secreted and then it is ejected like that. This has gone to a kind of gross place. Sorry about that.
Yummy.
but there we are.
Secrets of secretions, yeah. Or the secrets of secretions as told by Rob Watts.
So the original secrets were things that were set apart that not everyone was allowed access to, which kind of makes sense.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Speaking of secrets, what about the word covert? You mentioned when we were hinting at this earlier that covert and covert are equally valid, or
covert.
Yeah, okay.
Covert and covert. Yeah, or covert, if you want to have a nice rhotic American twang to it. And so here's the amazing thing. By the way, shout out to Professor Jeff Lindsay, who made a whole video about this. A very, very good video that is well worth a watch. He managed to find recordings of all kinds of people, for as long as they've been able to record things, pronouncing the word covert. And right up until the 60s, the 1960s, they're pronouncing it covert almost exclusively.
It's just the past participle of covered, like cover, right? Covered.
Yeah, you're right. So covert is to covered what burnt is to burned, right? So it's something that is in that state.
So probably a spy movie did this for us, right?
Well, I don't know. But in the 1960s, for whatever reason, an American pronunciation of covert appears, probably influenced by overt, right? And then you do get this dichotomy of overt and covert, which is an extremely elegant one, isn't it? The idea of something being open and something being closed. And rhetorically, it's very useful. Jeff Lindsay, in his wonderful video that we will, of course, link to, plays a clip of Martin Luther King using covert and overt in the same sentence as that beautiful trade-off that I was just talking about. Yeah, yeah. So then, after this sort of 1960s boom in the pronunciation covert, it takes over in America and it's taken over in Britain now. And actually, you don't hear people saying covert very often at all. It's by far the more common pronunciation now is covert. But to explain why they're different, as in overt and covert, they shouldn't be pronounced the same because they are from different places. They're from different French words that are not really related. You have couvert, which is covered in French, or cover, and you have ouvert in French. But isn't it weird that those two words look very similar? And it's thought that they look very similar for the same reason that we pronounce covert like overt. And it's that at some point, someone has decided that those two French words, so some French scholar has decided that they should be spelt similarly because they're probably related, but they're actually not.
You said spelt instead of spelled, which is same concept.
Yeah, good shout. Yeah, that's a really good one. Is that a transatlantic difference, spelt and spelled?
I would believe so. If you're talking about spelt, it's fish, right? Over here.
Oh, is that, yeah,
is it,
yeah,
fish? Am I making that up? No, it's wheat. Sorry, it's wheat. Yeah, it's not I don't know what fish I was thinking of.
I
knew that.
Type of wheat. Although I feel liberated in that. And I think most British people shop and change between spelt and spelled.
I was thinking of smelt. Smelt is the fish.
Oh, yeah, okay. Whoever smelt it, spelt it.
Right. And then, yeah, exactly. So we've got smelt and smelled, so.
Okay.
Anyway.
We're just saying words. I mean, I know this podcast is just saying words, but... Take us somewhere else, Jess.
Another thing you might do if you're a spy is you might surveil things or conduct surveillance. And surveil is an English back formation of surveillance, though it is also a French word. It's a little bit of both. Anyway, surveillance means to, or surveil means to watch over, surveiller. It's related to the word vigilant and vigil through the Latin root vigilare, meaning to watch. And it was introduced in English during the terror in France, where surveillance committees were formed to monitor people. I like how we have a little bit of French history throughout, like, all of spy history. Mm. It's very French.
Yeah. And I don't think nowadays we necessarily associate, despite the word espionage being overtly French, we don't necessarily think, they're not the first nationality that we think of when it comes to spying. Like, who are the big spy agencies? Yeah. KGB.
I have a thing here. Yeah, the KGB. We've got...
Which just doesn't exist anymore, obviously. They're not the KGB anymore.
But, like, they're still the villains in a lot of spy movies.
Yeah, so they were the Soviet spy agency. The big behemoth of Soviet spying. It's called the KGB. It's more fragmented now. You have the FSB, for example, which does a lot of what the KGB did, but there are other agencies that also do other bits and bobs that used to all fall under the banner of this big scary banner, this terrifying umbrella that would probably shoot a poison dart at you, of the KGB. The spy agencies in the UK, you've got GCHQ, which is the Government Listening Service, Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ stands for. But then you've also got MI5 and MI6. MI6 was the one that James Bond's involved with. So MI5 is sort of internal, MI6 is spying all over the world and that. So I was wondering, okay, well, was there an MI4? Was there an MI3? Was there ever an MI7? The answer is yes, there were all of those. It's quite a smart move when you're setting up a secret organization to put a number that is not one, because Then your enemy, if they do find out about it, thinks there's loads of these organizations.
Oh, they think there's another one.
They get
one.
Really scared. They're like, oh, I've got to find all these other ones.
That has the same energy as during senior pranks when people are about to graduate. I've seen it common to like set three pigs loose on campus and number them like 1, 2, and 4.
That's exactly the same idea. It's exactly the same idea. But there were these other MIs. So the MIs, they all come out of the Secret Service Bureau, which is set up in 1909. So it's just before the First World War, but they really come into their own during the First World War for the British. And you had MIR, which was the first one, which was concerned with information about Russia, Siberia, a lot of parts of Asia as well. MI1 was the Secretariat. So that's basically filing documents, stuff like that, distribution of such things. MI2 was information concerning more specific countries, so the Americas, the Ottoman Empire, showing its age there. MI3 was information concerning European countries like France, Belgium, Austria-Hungary, also Germany as well, so it would have been pretty key during that period. MI4 was responsible for collection and distribution of topographical information, so the drawing of maps, the sending of planes over enemy lines to draw maps based on, you know, where their trenches were running, etc. MI5 and MI6 are, as now, they're concerned with internal affairs and external affairs. MI7 was concerned with press censorship as well as military propaganda. MI8 was cable censorship, and MI9 was postal censorship. And that's it, as far as we know. If there was an MI10, it was even more secretive than the rest of them.
At some point, I want to get to encryption. But for the moment, I would also like to note, while I was looking into different types of encryption, noted that ULTRA was the designation for wartime signals intelligence by the British military. They were meant to encrypt and decrypt enemy radio and communications of all sorts during the 1940s. And one neat thing that they did is they used the code name Boniface as a cover name for ULTRA. So to ensure that the code breaking wasn't clear to the Germans, British intelligence created this fictional MI6 master spy named Boniface, who controlled a fictional series of agents through Germany.
This was Operation Boniface, because he got some quite fun code names from down the years. I think we should finish on those because they're quite fun. Let's get into decryption and the like and ciphers and such.
Before we do, I have one interesting thing to note here. So someone who works for these agencies is sometimes called, if not an agent, then an operative, right?
Yeah, good point.
Before the 1930s, the word operative was just a word for someone who operates things. And it became a word for a secret agent or spy because the Pinkerton Detective Agency found itself to be very unpopular due to its late 19th and early 20th century participation in violent labor disputes, acting as armed guards and strike breakers, and the accompanying bloodshed and anti-union tactics led to widespread criticism in labor circles, to the point where there was a piece in the New York Press from 1905 that says the word detective became so offensive because of the Pinkertons that it was dropped by many successful detective agencies. And the Pinkertons, which were called the Pinkerton Detective Agency, started calling its agents operatives instead.
But the word operative wasn't in use in that context at all.
Not as like a secret agent or anything like that, or someone who works for a spy agency.
That's interesting. And again, it's almost deliberately mundane and nonspecific, right? An operative is someone who does a thing.
And to be fair, operative, I think, is probably more broad than agent, right? Because an operative can be someone who is doing something on behalf of the organization without being a secret agent.
I keep diverting you away, and then you just diverted yourself away from talking about decryption and encryption, because obviously that's some of the really fun stuff when it comes to spy business, ciphers and the like.
Oh yeah, we should talk about cipher and crypt first, because crypt means hidden. In Greek, it was the full phrase cryptocamera, which was a hidden chamber, also related to the word camera, which means a chamber. And the shortened Latin crypta meant a vault or a cavern, just like crypt today. And so something encrypted therefore relies on the earlier Greek meaning. Encrypt means to hide. We've got cryptography as the practice of designing or breaking those systems, and then a cryptogram, which is a message that is hidden.
And cipher is worth a mention because it's related to a word you wouldn't necessarily think it was related to, like a fundamental word, a very fundamental word. It's related to the word zero.
Yes.
Like the word zero and the word cipher come from exactly the same Arabic source, which I'm going to let you pronounce because you're good at the Arabic pronunciations.
I believe it's sifr or sifr. It was the word for the number or the arithmetical notion of zero, and it was adopted into medieval Latin, then Spanish and Italian, and then Old French and English. And the Arabic word was a loan translation of a Sanskrit word meaning empty.
Right. Exactly. And that's key in both the sense of what zero means, obviously being empty as in there being nothing there, but also ciphers, a ciphered message looks like there's nothing there as well.
The version of cipher at the time came to mean any numeral in the 15th century. And then first in French as chiffre, it came to mean a secret way of writing or a coded message, because early codes often substituted numbers for letters. And another fun connection to spy fiction here is that Chiffre is also the name of the poker-playing, ball-busting villain, Le Chiffre, in the James Bond film Casino Royale, and as well as the parody version from the 60s.
And that's because chiffre is the French for number. It's just the French for any number, which is, again, quite interesting.
Should we talk about some famous ciphers?
Yeah, I don't think I know any famous ciphers, so enlighten me.
Sure, you know at least a few of them. One of the more common ones that you see, and the first few I'm going to talk about are very easy to decode. The Pigpen cipher is a big one. It's also called the Masonic cipher, Freemason cipher, Rosicrucian cipher, which is the Rose Cross cipher, Napoleonic cipher, and Tic-Tac-Toe cipher. And it involves setting letters on a grid and then representing the letters using the shapes of the grid with the letters removed. And the result looks like a set of geometric angles, squares, and dots. And the pig pen style cipher, these started appearing in writing as early as the 1530s. And it's super easy to break or decode, so often that you'll see it in logic quizzes and kids games and things. But it is a fun sort of like early introduction to code breaking.
Yeah, actually, just before we came on, you flashed it up to me and I did immediately work out the system.
Yeah.
It is one of those ones. Like if you've spent any time doing like IQ tests or stuff like that, it's a very quick one to work out. It's a classic. And also it's effective because if you do not have the relevant grid, you cannot work out what it says.
You have to treat it like a standard cryptogram and then figure it out in that capacity, which isn't super hard to do, but does take an extra layer of logic. I love cryptograms, by the way.
That's relying on like frequencies of letters and such.
Yeah.
Right?
So like if you have a totally scrambled, like randomized letter substitution cipher, then that's looking at the words in the sentence or the word, whatever the entry is, and determining based on the spaces and the frequency of letters what they might be. I created a bunch of cryptograms, and in 2020, I wrote all of the pages for the Writer's Digest 2020 page a day calendar, and about a fifth of it was puzzles and things like that. So I made a bunch of puzzles, and a bunch of them were literary quotes as cryptograms.
Oh, very smart. Very smart.
Let's talk about a little bit about the Caesar cipher. The Caesar cipher works by shifting each letter in a message forward or backward by a fixed number of places in the alphabet. And Julius Caesar used the substitution system when corresponding with allies in Rome during his military campaigns in Gaul. And each letter was replaced by another a set distance away. He often used one, according to these sources, with a left shift of three for the word W, for example, would be T. So words would be T-L-O-A-P.
Yeah, it's not really effective, is it?
No.
It's more of a game than an actual way of trying to get a secret message across, I'd have thought.
We're going to talk about another one. This is a Greek device that was used to send encoded messages, and it was called a cytale. A cytale was a pair or more of identically sized wooden rods, equal size and thickness of which, and around which would be wound parchment strips or leather straps with letters written all down the length. And if you have the right size rod, you wrap it around and the letters line up to create your message. But if your rod is the wrong size, then it doesn't work as well. And it's a series of these, so you have to make all of them fit correctly. I would have one rod and you would have the other one, and I could send you just the strips. And people might not interpret that the strips were anything other than leather or parchment with letters on them.
All the objects involved are completely useless without the rest of them, right? That's why it's effective. It's like two-step authentication.
Definitely.
You need a physical thing on your person as well to be able to... Well, I mean, everything was physical in the days we're talking about, right? They're not sending text messages to one another. But you got my point. It's a good point.
Whether these were actually used with any great frequency is debated, because we only really have, again, indirect evidence of Spartans and Athenians in particular using it. But Plutarch did write about it happening later. So there's that. One of the more successful and actually difficult to decipher ciphers, which is still, some elements are still debated today, was the Great Cipher of Louis XIV by the Rossinols. Anyway, they were a family of French cryptographers, and instead of using one symbol per letter, the Great Cipher used 587 numbers to represent French syllables, and some numbers represented things like deleting other letters. Ooh. So you had to have the code. The cipher was eventually broken in the 19th century, but there are still some elements that people talk about. And in one of the letters between the king and one of his officers appeared a possible solution to the mystery of the man in the iron mask, who was a real person, a real prisoner, who was kept imprisoned in an iron mask for 34 years during Louis's reign. And the cipher suggests that it might be a French general named Vivien du Boulogne, because there is a numerical code group that has been speculated to mean mask in it. But most historians think the man in the iron mask was actually Italian diplomat Ercole Antonio Mattioli.
I thought it was Leonardo DiCaprio.
Him too.
Has anyone seen that film? Does anyone remember that film? The Man in the Iron Mask? I love that film.
That was a formative experience for me. That and The Count of Monte Cristo were
oh, yeah,
some of my favorite books and movies back in the day.
Oh, okay. So it's Rossignol, by the way.
Rossignol, thank you.
Yeah, I hadn't come across it. Rossignol.
The Jefferson disc is another... It's the Jefferson wheel cipher or the Jefferson disc. And whether Jefferson himself invented this first, or it's based on earlier technologies, or whether he invented it at all isn't completely known, but he did have one. It's a rod with little discs slid onto it and sort of corn cobbed together, and you rotate them to align them with different things. And so the original version had you sitting on one side taking notes and me entering the code on the other side, like the actual message over here, and then you write down the code that appears on the other side. But the Jefferson disc has 36 wooden discs mounted side by side on a metal axle, with each disc having the alphabet in a different scrambled order. Mm-hmm. So it works like a combination lock on your luggage, where you rotate to unlock, but more elaborate. And to use the cipher, the sender aligns the wheels to spell a plain text message along one horizontal row. And then with the wheels left in that position, you copy down a different horizontal row that appears meaningless, and that you send only that string, and the person you're sending it to has to know which row you're looking at in order to decipher the encoded message.
Yeah. So they'd need to know the row, and they would need to have their discs in exactly the same order as you've got them as well.
Now, there is a similar device in the film The Da Vinci Code, and in the story and everything, and it is called, I think it's the cryptex or the puzzle box. It's not quite the same thing, but it does have kind of the same mechanic to it. And I mention that because the main character of The Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons is named Robert Langdon, and he is named after John Langdon, who designed the ambigrams that feature heavily in those novels. And they're like on the covers, and we see them everywhere. And he's often credited with being one of the more influential figures in the development of the modern ambigram. And I mention that too because I am wearing an ambigram shirt that we carry in our store. This is not an ad for this, but it is cool. And this one was designed by Nikita Prokhorov, who was mentored by John Langdon, who unfortunately passed away on the 1st of January in 2026. Rest in peace, John Langdon. And I'm I exchanged emails with him not too long ago, and he loved coming up with imaginative or digging into etymology possibilities that weren't necessarily true, but were interesting and tied into design. Like, he found a cool serendipitous link between the word zigzag and hieroglyphs and things like that, and sent me like some wonderful storytelling about it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, we've lost a true lover of words there, and not his first mention on this podcast either. And immortalized in at least the surname of the main character of one of the most popular books that's ever been written.
Not to mention, I think if you see the word Illuminati, there is a very good chance that it is done in the ambigram style that he designed.
We don't want to seem crass, but your hoodie's cool.
My hoodie's cool. It is cool.
this is brand new in our shop. This is the word. Right. So if you don't know what an ambigram is, certainly this one is anyway, it reads the same upside down. It says the same thing, although some ambigrams say a different thing when you rotate them through 180 degrees. Very elegant, that one that says etymology. I shall be getting one for myself, that's for sure.
One of the reasons I bring up John Langdon too is I was actually wearing this shirt when I found out today about his passing. So here's to John Langdon, and may you all appreciate his ambigrams in those stories and beyond. See you next time.